12:15 a.m. 24. Buck looks at me from a position of strength, preening like he's a rooster winning the cockfight. He's a fool. Doesn't he know all the animals die in those games? He has resumed his position, standing between me and my wife. I can't believe both of them, wearing their stupid matching lakeside tourist sweatshirts. Did they plan that too? Paul, sit down, he says. He points to the spot on the couch. I defy him, a little victory, and sit down in the closest blue club chair. I'm tired and bored with them. I yawn. Are we boring you, Paul? He asks. Cocky asshole, yes, you are, I say. Mia steps forward, closer to me. She's back. I think I've won her back. I smile my most winning smile and feel her being drawn toward me. I'm a magnet. I can almost reach out and touch her arm if she points to the documents on the table. Her red, blotchy, tear-streaked face is hideous in the candlelight, but I still love her, poor thing.
Paul, here is the separation agreement. I need you to sign it and then leave and go to the hotel room I reserved for you at the Lakeside Inn. All of your belongings have been taken there already, Mia says.
Her voice is quiet, shaky. I think maybe Buck has talked her into this whole ridiculous exercise. When I get her alone again, I'll smooth everything over. She stands and backs away, stopping next to Buck. From there, she adds,
Except I kept a couple of things you won't be needing.
How dare she rummage through my things? When did she even have the time? When I was at the store purchasing items for her, from her grocery list, just to make her happy. Bitch. But still, there is nothing of note hidden in my belongings, I'm sure. A little folder about the Texas land, that's all. I wonder again what else she knows. What is making her take this step? Mia, you surprise me. You've turned sneaky, conniving, a planner. Everything you hate in the world. Bravo, I say, raising an invisible glass in a mock salute. I've taught you well. Mia shakes her head. I'm unsure what to do next. Has she gone through my briefcase? What does she have? For a moment, my heart thuds in my chest as I remember the special envelope. I think back to the sink fire, relieved. Mia walks back toward the table, coming closer to me, holding a pen.
You will keep the home in Columbus as your primary residence, since it was yours when we married. The cottage will be mine. You'll see I've been more than fair about everything.
I wonder how many of her daddy's expensive New York City attorneys build time against this document. It doesn't matter, really. I know it will be airtight, unbreakable. I am signing the end to this gravy train. If I sign. I pretend Buck is not in the room and address only Mia. Look, honey, it's late. We're all tired, a little worked up. Why don't I go on over to the inn and we can look these things over in the morning? How's that? I ask. Mia looks at Buck. Buck stares at me. He says, No, that doesn't work. We need this signed tonight. I don't trust you to come back over. I don't believe anything you say. Who are you, anyway, and why are you here? I ask for the umpteenth time tonight, standing once more. Mia jumps back and hides behind Buck. The fire in my soul is starting to burn. I want you out of my house now. This is between my wife and me.
Paul, calm down,
Mia says. She has stepped toward me again. Buck stops her, placing a hand on her shoulder. She turns and looks up at him. She's a traitor. May I? He asks her. Mia looks at him like a lost puppy dog and nods a silent yes. Clearly my mutt needs a little retraining. It's Buck's turn to take a step toward me, putting himself between Mia and me, his favorite position tonight. Sit back down and I'll tell you everything. And then you will sign and you will leave. You can even go back to Columbus tonight if that's your preference. It's an interesting idea. Maybe I will do that. Head back home, enjoy the drive without Mia's nonsense in the passenger seat. She can be stranded up here with Buck and her strawberry babies. I'll be home by 3, climb into bed, and wake up with the boys in the morning. After Claudia leaves, I'll begin explaining to them why they won't ever see their mommy again. They'll have a new, young brunette mommy named Gretchen. Or if for some reason I can't finagle anything out of Mia, perhaps I'll find another woman with money. It'll all work out. I know women. This is my favorite subject. I think about that option, a new wealthy lover. It's enticing, especially if I agree to leave. Mia will take most of the assets. I'm sure that's in the document. She doesn't know about the second mortgage on the Columbus house. I needed some emergency funds a while back. Without Donald's Christmas gifts or Mia's seemingly endless gravy train from her parents, cash will be tight for the boys and me. Except, I remember, they have a trust fund. I smile and sit down in my favorite chair as Buck takes a seat in the other blue chair. Gretchen could work as long as I have the boys' trust fund. I have choices. Many choices much better than this one. Mia seems to be hiding in the corner, a trapped gray creature. She looks like a rat, a sneaky rat with shiny, beady rodent eyes. The room is hot. I feel sweat trickle down my back, and I'm the only one not wearing a ridiculous lakeside sweatshirt. Why isn't Buck sweating too? He seems calm, almost too calm. He leans toward me, resting his elbows on his thighs, his chiseled chin on top of his clasped hands. I fight the urge to deck him then and there. Curiosity stops me from punching him just yet. I need to hear what good old Buck has to say. 12:20 a.m. 25. Buck says, I know you have Googled me, trying to figure me out. Isn't that right, Paul? No need to answer. Mia told me you did it together. What did you find? Not much. Just that you sold your company. Your wife is dead. Besides that, you haven't had a very notable life, I'm afraid, I tell him. If you Google Paul Strom, you'll get pages of accolades, Addy Awards for advertising campaigns I helped lead, civic awards for the community activities I've been involved in, and of course links to my very famous father-in-law, too. I'm all over the internet, as I should be. Of course, I also made an appearance in my parents' obituaries, the favorite son who lived right next door. So loyal. I didn't include Tom in the write-up. He didn't deserve the acknowledgement, the ghost. Some people prefer to be hidden, Buck says. My company, the one I sold last year, handles security for high-net-worth individuals. Neither my clients nor I wish for any personal publicity, and we allow only very carefully controlled public information out in the world. Oh, so you're some sort of spy, is that it? I ask. I was right about him. My instincts are finely tuned. I remain one step ahead of this imitation James Bond. Actually, former special ops, but that's not important now. What you do need to know is that we've been watching you, Buck says. For a while now. The candle closest to me sizzles out, a plume of dark smoke announcing its demise. The other, in the middle of the table, had burned out sometime earlier. That leaves only one candle flickering on the coffee table. In the corner, I see Mia open the hutch and pull out another candle. It's reflex. At Lakeside, there are often severe thunderstorms that can knock the power out for hours or days. We've stocked up on candles, and they are tucked everywhere. Of course, tonight is cloudless, and the lights are on, although dimmed, ironically, by me for our romantic after-dinner drink. I focus my attention back on Buck and his special ops announcement. I know it is a threat, a warning not to get physical, but I still have fire in my core. Sometimes rage can overpower training. You've been watching me. How charming. Why, I say. He knows I don't find this charming, but I'm also a bit disturbed. Something in the back of my mind is trying to push to the front. Because from the moment I met you, I knew something was off. Really off. Greg confirmed it. You know, your former friend, Greg Boone. What is it with these idiots, the Boones? Why can't they mind their own business? Greg Boone is a sore loser. A loser, period, I say. Be that as it may, I have the resources to check people out. And you are not what you seem. Or, more precisely, you are part of the 1%. I don't think Buck is referring to income. Clearly he must be aware of our current financial squeeze. 1%, I ask. Classic malignant narcissist, possible psychopathic. All the definitions really blend together, but it's you. You have no conscience, have a psychological need for power and control, and you think you are more important than anyone else. You lured Mia into your web when she was young and inexperienced. You lie constantly, and you have no shame. You won't take responsibility for any of this, will you? Buck says. He pauses, and we smile at each other. What does he expect? Should I pretend to be shocked? I know who I am. I'm special. Unique. Whatever you say, Buck. Why do you think you know so much about this subject? Takes one to know one, am I right? Buck doesn't answer me, just shakes his head as my wife appears from behind him. Her hand is on the back of the chair, but I know she wants to touch his shoulder. She better not. She knows she better not touch him like that in front of me. Ever. I am staring at her. I am waiting for her to make a big mistake.
I asked Buck to help me because I thought I was losing my mind, Mia says.
She walks over to the coffee table, where we are locked in our little tête-à-tête, but stays as far as possible away from me. She lights the new candle with the flame of the old one, places it in the holder, and sits down on the couch, much nearer to Buck's chair than mine. She has dripped wax on the table. So sloppy.
Ever since the boys started school, I've felt so un-me, so needy. If you had let me out of the house, maybe things would be different, but I don't know. And then I got sick, but it doesn't matter. It's your pattern that's the problem. I mean, what is so wrong with me that you had to find lovers during our engagement, and then during our marriage? How many were there, Paul? You lie about everything. You try to steal my money? How did you make it all seem like it was my problem, like something was wrong with me? I just didn't understand. I was trapped in this world you'd created, a prison. You're the lunatic, Paul, not me.
So, you two are doing it, I say, my eyes roving over my wife and then over Buck. I sound like a teenage boy in the sports locker room, I know. It's for shock value. It works. Mia puts her hand over her mouth. Her eyes bug out at me. Buck starts to stand. Will he come at me? Mia holds her hand up and he stays seated, but he's seething. Good. He says, don't be crass. This isn't about me. This is about you. Mia and I worked on the garden together last summer. Do you remember? She had 2 weeks up here without you. Just the boys and gardening. I saw her relax, come to life. I gave her some suggested reading materials. Buck looks at Mia and nods, prodding my wife like a shepherd herding his lost sheep. It works. Mia leans toward me and says,
I learned about what you are, that there was a name for this. I learned it wasn't me. I am not the crazy one. But still, it took me all winter to get the courage to leave you. When you got fired, and when I found out why, that sealed it. But I knew you wouldn't let me leave without a fight.
That's where I come in, me and my people. We've been tailing you, Paul, Buck says. I squint my eyes, staring a hole in Buck's forehead. Why do he and Mia seem to finish each other's sentences, like an old married couple? It's getting annoying. But it doesn't matter. What could he possibly have seen if he was following me? Nothing, of course. I fail to see why anyone would want to follow a successful businessman going to work each day and returning home to his beautiful family in their gorgeous suburban home, I say. Buck is smirking. I am almost positive, though his expression remains stoic. Nothing is ever what it seems, you know that, Paul, he says. We follow you every weekday as you visit your lover, Gretchen. How dare he say her name in front of Mia? My brain registers this daunting fact, and then I realize she probably has seen photos. Poor Mia. I'll need to give her a really big hug. Mia's head has dropped into her hands. She has no impact on us, Mia. I love you. You're my wife. She is just, well, for sex, I say. Oh, God, Buck says. On the couch, Mia is shaking again. I start to stand up, to go comfort her. Buck places his hand on my thigh, squeezes my leg hard, and says, "Sit down. Now." 12:25 a.m. 26. I lower myself into the chair again, but he can't make me stay here. Nobody can make me do anything. I feel the fire surging inside me. I will not be forced to sit for long. "You've got quite a history with women, haven't you, Paul? We know about Lois, your first wife. I spent an afternoon with her. Lovely woman. Still terrified of you. Funny how you never mentioned to Mia that you'd been married before," Buck says. "Not relevant. Not at all. How dare he stomp around in my business? I know I never told you I was married to Lois. It was a short, messy affair. Best to just move on, and that's why I never discuss it. I had made a very rare miscalculation. I thought I should marry young. It was part of the package of an up-and-coming, successful advertising executive. I had the vision of how my life would look in my head. I just needed to fill in the actual people to play the roles. The moment I met Lois in class, I knew she was perfect prey. She would fit the role of wife exactly as I imagined. I worked my charms, waiting for her after class with an armful of her favorite white daisies, for example, and later leaving little love notes in her backpack each morning for her to find during class. It was all romantic, and no surprise that she fell for me, hook, line, and sinker. But I had that regrettable lapse of control and allowed my mask to slip. That would not happen again. No, best not to tell anyone about Lois. That story is over. The end. Lois's divorce papers were simplistic, but I'd gladly signed. Good riddance. And I'd never discuss it now with this man. Lois, Caroline Fisher, Rebecca Moore, all of these women and others, both you and I know about, are terrified of you. None of them knew about your pattern of behavior, that it has been going on your entire life. They all do now. If you think you can get away with hurting any of them or threatening them again, you are very wrong, Buck says. I don't know what kind of picture you're trying to paint of me, but I resent the implications. I've never laid a hand on my wife, on Mia. She will confirm that, right, honey? I ask. I look over at Mia, now curled up in a ball, her feet tucked beneath her in the corner of the couch. I want to go hug her and strangle her all at once. It's a pleasant sensation that I allow to brew inside me. I do not believe that Buck can match my fire. I can take him if I choose to. You've probably figured it out by now, haven't you? My little plan for our best day ever. My sickly little wife, my secret stash of powder. The two are related, of course. But what would hurt my wife the most at this point, given these new facts laid out by her lover? What would hurt her most, her death by my hand or never seeing her children again? It's an interesting question. I'd planned the former, but now I may need to regroup. There are always options when you are smarter than everyone. Gretchen and I will sell the Columbus house, use whatever proceeds I make to start over. I read that Nashville is booming, one of the fastest-growing cities in the country. Maybe we'll move there. I've read it's more than country music now, much more. Lois likes it there, and it will be fun to run into her again. I like my new plan. So the little meeting tonight is to get me to sign these papers, to give up the cottage, which is fine with me, given the neighbors, no offense, Buck, and I get the Columbus home. Is that correct? I ask. Yes, the gray ball in the corner of the couch says. As long as you agree to leave me, the boys, and my family alone. My laugh breaks the silence of the room. Mia, you're hysterical. The boys will be with me. They need a father figure. They've outgrown all of that mommy care. It's time for them to become men, which I've talked to her about incessantly. Does she forget everything I've taught her? It's natural for the boys to begin pulling away from their mother and turn to me, their father. It's expected. And so, of course, they'll be with me. Mia is staring at me, and so is Buck. I want to reassure her that this is the way it is all meant to be. And it is. You'll be able to visit, don't worry. You've done a good job with them. Now it's my turn, I say. It's as if I'm talking to a child. We review the same points ad nauseam. It's frustrating. I feel my right hand clench. I push a smile onto my lips, running my tongue across my teeth. I'll be with them tonight as soon as I get out of here. Nothing to worry about. Mia uncurls, puts her feet on the floor, leans forward and says, "The boys will be with me. Period." I fight the urge to reach for her, to slap her, hard, so hard she flies across the room, a gray ball flying into oblivion, her head cracking against the floor. "It's all here, in the agreement you will sign," Buck says. I know he is redirecting my attention to him. Foolish man, to get in the middle of my life, to get with my wife. He had better watch his back. "I will divide the property, but I will not consent to giving up my children. Who would ask that? That's wrong. Boys need their fathers. Look at the terrorists. Look at the prison system. The prisons are filled with boys without male role models," I say. "It's true. We all know it." "Sometimes no role model is better than a terrible one. It may have taken me too long to see you for what you are, but they're still young enough to be saved. You haven't revealed yourself to them. You haven't used them or hurt them, and for that I'm very grateful. You should know if you had touched them, hurt them, I would have left you. But you know that already, don't you? That's why you haven't laid a hand on them, I suppose. They've been sheltered from your life outside of our home, from the truth of who their father really is. I've researched this, Paul. They don't have to end up like you, with your temper and other issues. They won't, not if I can help it. My dad will be a much better role model for them, among others." Did Mia just look at Buck? I'm going to kill him. For some reason, Mia is still talking. She adds, "And they're going to be fine. They will both become good men, despite you." My wife crosses her arms in front of her chest and smiles. How did I not see a browsing history of these types of things, I wonder? She must have deleted her history. She must have hidden her reference books. She must have become like me. I think back, trying to remember if she was acting differently around me recently. She wasn't jumpy or anything at the dinner table. She didn't look at me with suspicious eyes. But she had been happier lately, despite her illness, her weight loss. I just thought it was acceptance. Turns out it was awakening. I missed the signs. I squeeze my hands into fists. She's droning on again. Mia says, "They'll get counseling, a financial security from my parents until I get on my feet again. It's all worked out." Ah, yes, her parents. There better be a big payout in those papers for me. Two children, boys, white, smart, blue eyes. They are worth a lot these days. We're almost a minority. "So what are you proposing to pay me, you and your dear father, Donald, to steal my children, to buy my sons from me?" I ask. This is a game. I enjoy playing games. I enjoy the look my wife gives me as we discuss our children like property. She looks ill suddenly. All the color is drained from her face. "You are a sick bastard," Buck says. If I punched him quickly in the temple, I could stun him long enough to reach for Mia. It's an intriguing and exciting thought. I see the candle drip wax onto the coffee table. I'd like to push the candle over, start a fire, and torch this cottage. It would go fast with the old wood, all the wood floors, shingled roof. Poof. All gone. It's tragic that Buck and Mia perish in the fire, But sometimes cheaters get what they deserve.
I understand who you are, Paul. The sad thing is, people like you don't change, even with intense counseling. Somehow you walk around in the world among us, hidden, manipulating others, hurting others. Even the people you claim to love. I know you don't feel love. You couldn't and do what you do.
Mia stops, bites her lip. She shakes her head slowly. She looks at me with pity, her face drawn. I won't stand for this. Mia holds her hand up, pointing her finger at me.
I know you're trying to poison me, that you have been poisoning me. I opened the glove box to freak you out during the drive up today.
She pauses, then tilts her head.
It worked, didn't it?
12:35 a.m. 27. The room is silent, as if none of us were breathing. I stare at my wife, incredulous. My mouth has dropped open, and I feel the cool air of the room hitting the back of my throat. As for it working, if she is referring to the poison I may or may not have given her, clearly it didn't. Instead of just washing her waste away, I should have killed her in one big dose. A miscalculation, for sure. At first, I rather enjoyed the disintegration of my wife. The slow disappearance as she wasted away despite her clean diet, healthy lifestyle. Ironic, isn't it? And of course I picked this path because small doses are easier to hide. I never had to worry, though. All of the fancy doctors she consulted, regular and hippie, never did the special urine test for this particular poison. It's the only way to detect arsenic poisoning, and even then it must be within 3 days of the dose. I was finished with Mia, yes, but I didn't want an abrupt end. Gretchen and I had grown so close, and, well, the wife felt like the proverbial ball and chain. At the same time, I know that a sudden death is so hard on children. Mommy slipping away slowly is much better on them. The long goodbye, so to speak. I was thinking of the boys, as always. I never had to worry. There was a firm timeline to my plan. Sure, it shifted, I'll admit, but this weekend, this final time together, well, it was precipitated by my need for resources, my dwindling supplies, and, of course, my love for my boys. They deserve the finest in life. Their inheritance will assure it. It had to end tonight. But still, I'd wanted a romantic final day with my wife, my little Mia. She deserved it, she did. Until this, the best day ever, turned into something else. Turned into this. Until Buck, the bastard. They're both staring at me. Mia's mouth is open a bit like she's trying to speak, trying to think of something to say. But now I have the floor. She asked me a question. You never freak me out, Mia, to use your childish phrase. Look at you, sniveling, scrawny, unkempt with mascara streaks down your face. How could you ever think you have any power over me? I ask. Time to sign the papers, Paul, Buck says. He reaches over to the coffee table and picks up the pen. Shiny and silver, it seems expensive. I wonder who it belongs to. Maybe Mia's father, maybe Buck. If I sign, I will take it with me as a reminder of this moment, of the inferno inside me, and of the revenge I'll extract. It will be a touchstone for revenge. And if I don't, I ask.
I'll press charges. Attempted murder, Mia says. We have the proof. Photos of you with the envelope. Photos of you pouring the powder into my brandy.
I think of the kitchen window over the sink. It doesn't have curtains or a shade. I kick myself for my complacency, for my lack of caution. I never imagined someone could follow me successfully, not without my spotting a tail. Now I realize there was someone watching us at the restaurant as well. It was probably Buck. That's who Mia was smiling to through the window. Of course. You ended up lacing your wife's brandy with sugar, sport, Buck says. He is smiling at me, as if he has won. He is not. He doesn't know me. He doesn't know anything. You followed us tonight to the restaurant, You bribed the valet, switched my envelope for yours. That's why it took that punk valet so long to find my car, I say. I typically figure things out quickly. In this case, not quickly enough. They have the evidence, the arsenic. Well, you'll have trouble making any of this nonsense stick.
You're denying it, Paul? We have proof. You are trying to kill me.
Clearly, Mia is agitated again. She's shaking and mucus is running out of her nose. Mia, it's okay. Calm down, Buck says. He doesn't make a move to comfort her. He knows better. Knows not to turn his back to me right now. He should also know I'll be back for him later. I will be. Sign this and get out of here. Buck jabs the pen into my thigh. I take it from him. I imagine stabbing him in the neck. I could do it, too. So, if I sign this, I realize, I'm agreeing to give up custody of my children. What they don't realize is I will tell the court I was threatened, forced to sign this agreement against my will. I will not go quietly into the night. Not at all. I pull the cap off the pen. It is a very nice pen, heavy in my hand. I reach for the papers. You can read the documents if you'd like, but we've explained the contents. This will be a separation followed by a complete dissolution of your marriage, like it never even happened. Papers will be filed on your behalf. Sign the agreement where marked, Buck says. Here and here. He's so helpful, good old Buck. But still, I smile and do as I'm told. I scan the words, sole custody, property, rights, dissolution. As I expected, she keeps everything except our home in Columbus. But that's fine. There is plenty left to liquidate, even with the second mortgage. There is a treasure trove of expensive furniture, antiques, and art from her parents. I'll be fine starting over. And I'm good at this, beginning anew and being patient about revenge. I know there is always more than one way to skin a cat. Now probably is not the time to tell you about my own pet's premature demise. Tommy was heartbroken. We'll save that for another time. I finish with the papers and pen, and Buck collects them from the table. I sit back in my chair and watch the show. Without breaking eye contact with me, Buck holds the papers in the air in my wife's direction. He says, Mia, take a look. Be sure we didn't miss a signature line. I watch Mia reach for the papers. With steady hands, she slowly turns each page. She places the document on her thighs.
All signed.
I watch as she swallows. She looks relieved. She's no longer crying. She looks at me, unblinking, unafraid. She places the pen on the coffee table. For now, she has won, and she knows it. Time to go, sport. You will check in and stay the night at the inn. Understood? Buck says. He stands and stares down at me. Fine. I'm happy to get out of here. Where did you say you took my stolen belongings? I ask. I grab the pen and stand. I am eye to eye with Buck, nose to nose. The Lakeside Inn. The nice one on the lake. Talk to Scott. He is holding your things behind the front desk for you until you check in, Buck says. I take a step back and then turn and walk toward the kitchen. Foolishly, my wife has left the unconsumed snifter of brandy and sugar on the kitchen counter. I start to reach for it as a firm hand yanks my shoulder backward, holding me in place. Don't even think about it. You know as well as I do that even though we allowed you to lace her drink with sugar, it's still evidence. Keeping his hand on my shoulder, Buck forces me to the back door, opens it, and almost pushes me outside. He tosses my car keys onto the driveway. Rude. These are things I will not forget. Ever. I hear him slam the back door shut behind me and turn the lock in the knob. Like that type of lock could stop anyone from coming inside. He's dreaming. I roll the heavy pen in my pocket. I'm tired of both him and my wife. Good riddance. I stand in front of the closed garage door. Surely he will know, if he has been doing good spy work, that I cannot enter my garage through the broken side door, that I must enter by pushing the button inside the kitchen. Ah, yes, he's watching. I hear the garage door moan and start to open. I stand with my back to the house, waiting for my chance to escape. Still, as I climb into my car and back out, I see Buck watching me through the kitchen window. I wonder if he'll sleep there, at my cottage, with my wife, tonight. I wonder how confident Buck will feel about closing his eyes, now and forever. 1 a.m. 28. I drive too quickly down our street, checking my rearview mirror to see if I've been followed. I'm almost certain Buck will remain with Mia, comforting the poor woman. She is a mess, that's for sure. Good riddance. I turn my blinker on to take a left at the corner, pausing for a moment to stare into the Boone's now dark cottage. I guess the party is over for tonight. I wonder if Greg lost at euchre again. If I had more time, I would go inside and have a little talk or something with Greg and Doris. Perhaps demonstrate to them the trouble you can get into when you're a gossipy, nosy neighbor. Unfortunately, they will need to learn their lesson when we're all back in Columbus. I take a left onto 2nd Street and drive to the old stately inn. We stayed here once with the kids before we were owners. It's a passable place to stay for some people once you get past the musty smell. I will not be a guest. I just need to collect my things. I park in a spot out front labeled check-in only and turn off the car. As I step outside, I look around, checking my surroundings. The lake is behind me, just beyond the expanse of green lawn that belongs to the inn. A large stone fountain gurgles water, making an oddly eerie sound in the otherwise silent night. Across the street is the beginning of the park, and farther down I see the outline of the boathouse and the dock. It is very dark, very still out here. There is no one else around. I'm certain I haven't been followed as I make my way up the steps and into the lobby. Directly across from me, behind a large wooden desk with a sign that says reception, a bored teenage boy, cheeks covered with acne and sallow-looking, stifles a yawn and says, "Hello, are you checking in?" His lack of tension makes me realize I've been holding my shoulders tight, and I smile and relax a bit. "Hello, son. Some friends of mine kindly dropped off my suitcase and belongings here, but I'm afraid I can't spend the night," I say. I'm using my best and friendliest face, my most polite words. I am imitating the waiter from tonight. I am overly kind.
"Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, then, do you want your stuff?"
the boy asks. He is wearing a name tag that says Scott. The name tag is gold and shiny. The word is printed in black. "Please, yes, Scott," I say. I'm friendly. Just a patient, weary traveler who needs his shit now, Scott.
"Your name? And I need to see some identification, too,"
Scott says. I wonder how many people drive up to a hotel at 1 a.m. and try to retrieve a stranger's things. In Lakeside? I suspect the risk is low, but Scott is only doing his job. I tamp down my brewing impatience and slide my driver's license over to him.
"Be right back,"
he says, barely glancing at the license. I collect it and slip it back into my wallet. I realize I have not a dime to tip this kid, nor do I have a working credit card for gas. This is not the best scenario, as I must hurry back to Columbus. I look around for a camera, but of course I don't see any. Lakeside Inn is a trusting, folksy place, devoid of crime and suspicion, apparently. Slowly I walk around the counter and see what must be the cash drawer, slightly ajar, just in front of where Scott had been sitting. I reach over, open the drawer, and extract all of the $20 bills and the one $50 bill in there, shoving them into my front pocket. I push the drawer closed and return to my original place in front of the reception desk, making sure my face is still kind and friendly. Only once I'm safely back in position on the customer's side of the desk do I realize I should have stolen his tip. Oh well, poor kid will just have to survive on my smile.
"Here we are, Mr. Strom,"
Scott says, appearing through the same door he'd disappeared through a moment before, now rolling out a luggage cart containing my suitcase and briefcase.
"This is your stuff, right?"
It is. Thank you, son, I say as he pushes the cart around to my side of the desk. I grab my suitcase, yank up the handle, slide my briefcase on top, and, nodding to the helpful boy, roll quickly to the door.
Sir, are you sure you won't be checking in? There's still a room reserved for you, Scott calls to me as I am almost through the door.
No, son, change of plans, but thank you. Have a good night, I say, with another big smile for the lad. I feel a little terrible he will be accused of stealing the money in his drawer and no doubt be fired, but it's a good life lesson. He should have been more careful, should have locked that cash drawer before he left his post. You just never know who you're dealing with, despite appearances. As I roll my bags to my car, I realize I should check and make sure Mia put everything back in my suitcase, but I'll have to do that once I arrive back home. I pop the trunk, shove the briefcase and suitcase inside, fight the urge to look around again, and quickly climb into the car. I lock the doors, turn the key in the ignition. Before pulling away from the curb, I consider my options. What I know I should do, what I want to do is start driving, head for Port Clinton and then the highway to take me back home. But another part of me wants to circle back to my cottage, have what you might call the final word with Buck and my wife. That is what Buck will expect, I'm sure, especially if Scott tips him off that I'm not checking in. Maybe I'll just drive by the cottage one last time, you know, on my way out of the gates. It will give me time to think things over. Although glancing at my gas gauge, I know I don't have much time to think without filling up. As I drive down 2nd Street heading toward my cottage, I smile, remembering my petty theft. If I'm lucky, Scott won't check the cash drawer for the rest of the evening, and whoever replaces him on the morning shift will assume Scott took the cash. He is an untrustworthy teenager, after all. If I'm unlucky and Scott notices the missing 20s, surely he won't think of the kind stranger, dressed nicely, obviously successful and from the city. No, it would have had to be someone else, earlier in the night. I was nice to him, although I didn't tip him. If I had taken the cash, surely I would have tipped him, he'd reason. Unless Buck has told him things about me, spreading more rumors, darkening my name, I will need to get in front of Buck and his lies. I drive slowly around the corner at the Boone's cottage. It's dark and unmoving, as it should be at this time of night. In contrast, across the street, my cottage is awash in light. There are 2 squad cars parked in my driveway, and through the brightly lit windows I see too many people walking around inside my family room. I spot Mia through the window, sitting on the couch, my couch, drinking a cup of tea, feeling all smug and secure. She's surrounded by cops, telling the little sob story of her unhappy life. Poor little crumpled gray Mia. Her husband was such a bad man. He gave her a big house, 2 healthy boys, a life of leisure beyond most people's wildest dreams. I touch the shiny pen I placed on the passenger seat. It's cool, like my wife. Unlike me, Mia is a spoiled brat who got everything she wanted, everything she deserved. I put the pen in my pocket, turn off the headlights, and park one house down from ours on the same side of the street. There aren't many streetlights in Lakeside, none near our cottage. The stars are obscured by clouds. It's dark, very dark on our street. Mia complains about that, but I am a creature of the shadows. I'm comfortable here, as you know. I spot my target near his precious strawberry garden, the very thing that caused all of this. Buck has let his guard down because the cops, country guys who should be home banging their wives or swilling moonshine, are protecting her. One of the officers even sports a soul patch on his chin, so 3 years ago. I turn my attention back to Buck. Buck's retreated to the garden, my garden, letting the authorities comfort my gray blob of a wife. He's such a loser. It's so easy. I creep into my yard undetected. He doesn't even know what's hit him from behind until I do, my rage overpowering his supposed training. I have him in a chokehold. Buck fights like the tough guy I know he is, but I'm stronger. He skids the heel of his shoe down my shin, but he's wearing tennis shoes. Lame. I squeeze his neck tighter, hear him gasping for breath. I pull him to the ground behind the strawberries and straddle his chest. I punch him in his pretty face, direct contact with that dimple, that perfect jaw. The sound is thick, satisfying. My hand stings. I love it. It makes me feel alive. I kick him in the side once. I hope to crack a rib. That should keep him from humping my wife for a while. I stand above him. He rolls to his side, tries to stand, but I'm not letting that happen. My shoes are dress shoes with a pointed toe. I aim at his temple, then his ribs, and I kick his throat. He moans and then is still. Take that, tough guy. I'm done here. I won't kill him. No, that would be too easy. I feel the heavy pen in my pocket. Imagine it sticking out of his neck, piercing his artery. I like the image, but I want him alive. I will make him pay for what he's done to me, slowly, over time. But I assure you, he will pay for ruining my life, for stealing my wife. When he least expects it, I'll get my revenge. I hear voices and duck behind the strawberry bed. The cops are heading out, walking to their cars. The idiots are going to leave Mia alone, in our house. I cover my mouth with my hand. My white smile could give me away. I'm like a shark, lurking in the depths, waiting to strike. The two police cruisers flip on their headlights and pull away. I turn toward the cottage. Mia stands in the window, staring into the backyard. It's almost as if she knows I'm here. I begin to wave. She's not looking for me, though. At my feet, Buck moans. So much for special ops, guys. I kick him in the ribs. Shut up, I say. My voice is firm, commanding. I really don't have time for this garden gnome. I need to rescue my wife, from herself, from this story she's concocted in her mind. Poor woman. Hello, Mia, I whisper, looking toward the brilliantly lit cottage. Don't worry, I'm home. I take a step toward the house as a hand clamps on my ankle. Fucking Buck. What is his problem? This time I yank my foot out of his grip and kick him in the head. There's a satisfactory thud, and blood flows out of his ear. It would be so easy to off him, I think, squeezing the pen in my pocket. But I need to get to Mia. I run to the back door, kick it open. I told you the lock was ridiculous. That was easy, and I'm definitely not special ops. Mia screams from the other room. She's going to be so happy to see me. I hurry through the kitchen to the family room. She's running to the front door. I grab her hair, stopping her dead in her tracks. She stumbles back. Her hand grabs mine. She spins around, a puppet in my hands. What now, little Mia? It takes me a moment to see the knife. She slashes at me with the fury of a feral cat. She comes close to my hand, and I release her hair. Mia is shaking. The knife is barely capable of slicing an apple, but she points it at me, acting heroic. Get out of here, Paul. I've pushed the panic button. Help is on the way, and Buck is just outside. Buck is a little busy with the strawberries right now. Poor guy. I smile as Mia's eyes get larger. What have you done to him? She hisses. Nothing he didn't deserve. But let's talk about us, shall we? I smile. I say, panic button. Really? What panic button, honey? You really must be losing your mind. There is no panic button. That's for the movies. Besides, you couldn't have anything like that, not without me knowing about it. You have nothing without me. You are nothing without me. My hand is throbbing from punching Buck. I like that. Get out of here, Paul. I'm serious. You don't want to be caught breaking in here. Mia's little knife is wobbling again. It's cute. Mia, this is my cottage, our cottage. We own it, so I couldn't possibly break in. I think you've forgotten how many good memories we've made here, even in one short year. Remember the champagne toast on our new screened porch when we first bought this place, and how happy we were. I'm smiling. Mia is not.
And all the while you were poisoning me, she says, shaking her head.
Oh, honey, don't be silly, I say. I haven't been poisoning her the entire time, silly woman. Come here, let me give you a hug. You seem so distraught. You're lost without me. I take a step toward my wife, and she backs into the corner by the front door, slashing the air between us with her little cheese knife. Perhaps I'll teach her a little lesson. It's at that moment, as we're studying each other, contemplating our next moves, that I hear sirens. The sound is faint, but growing louder, definitely coming toward us. Mia must hear her rescuers in the distance, and finally manages a smile, possibly the most genuine smile of the day. It's the half-moon kind of smile, like the one she gave me this morning, like she gave me when we first dated, a smile of love. But then her face falls, as if that smile is not for me, not anymore. Wrong, Paul. I am much more than you, and I'm so much better off without you. Her ridiculous paring knife is clutched in her hand, pointed at me. It would be so easy to grab it, turn the blade toward her, plunge it into her traitorous chest. The sirens are closing in. She does have a fucking panic button. Now I must decide. Finish what I started with the poison, or get out before the Keystone cops arrive, grab my kids, and start over. Because clearly she hasn't thought of everything. Our kids, our precious boys, are at home asleep, blissfully unaware of all of this strife, like little lambs just waiting for their shepherd to save them. Red and blue flashes are lighting up the street. I've got to get out of here. This isn't over, Mia, but for now, good night, honey. Sleep tight. We'll see each other again soon. Perhaps when you least expect it, I say, before turning and running out the back door through the yard to my car. The cops drive past me as I sit low in my front seat, flying into our driveway at speeds that could only be considered excessive. You'd think there was an actual crime taking place inside. Instead, they'll find a crazy woman huddled by the front door with a tiny knife and, eventually, a former special ops guy knocked out by his precious strawberry plants. Losers. Both of them. My poor little wife. She thinks she is so clever. Outsmart Paul Strom. Never. I push the gas and drive by quickly. Decision made. I find myself constantly checking my mirrors, rear view and side, until I escape through the lakeside gate. I know I'm driving too fast, even if all of the cops from this entire little township are busy at my cottage for now, and I pull my foot back from the gas pedal. I need to conserve fuel until I make it to a bigger town where there will be an open gas station. It would not be prudent to run out of gas somewhere in the middle of these dark country roads tonight. I have too much more to take care of for that. 1:45 a.m. 29. I haven't noticed another car on the road with me for miles, and believe me, I've been looking. At night, if you are aware, you can spot a tail. It's easy when you have to keep your lights on to see. And out here in the country, you need your headlights. If Buck or his people were following me, they aren't anymore. I tighten my grip on the steering wheel, remembering how Buck's people followed me around Grandville, spied on my life. How could I have missed them? The gas station is a still life. Pumps ablaze in two bright fluorescent light, but everything is eerily motionless except for a large moth diving in and out of the scene. I roll to a stop and climb out of the flex. It's interesting to me how much my palms are sweating, although I hadn't registered in my mind anything like fear. My body feels tense, on edge. I remind myself to breathe as I look around. I'm the only one here, except the person working in the station. As I walk toward the silhouette of a man sitting behind the counter, I smile and notice the camera. That's fine, too. We are all being videotaped all the time now. If anyone cares to retrieve that tape, it will simply prove that I decided to drive home instead of spending the night in the musty inn. No crime there. The gas station door is locked. I shake the handle as the employee, a burly man whose other job could be biker, leans forward and presses a button. "Need gas?" the voice booms through a speaker. No, I just wanted to stop by and say hi, my busy mind thinks. I wonder why I don't just move to another country. People here are such simpletons. His brother is probably one of the cops assigned to protect Mia. Equally effective. So stupid, all of them. Yes, pump one. $40, I say. I've located the after-hours pay drawer. I pull out my wallet as he slides the drawer open. I place two crisp $20 bills in the drawer, and he closes the hatch. I wonder if he feels safe, locked inside a fully lit glass building. He shouldn't. Pump one is on, he says. His voice is impatient, as if he has better things to do than supply gas to late-night drivers. But that is his only function. I shrug him off. I'm the one in a hurry, I remind my tense body. Turning my back to the thug, I return to my car and begin pumping gas. I'm now standing in a pool of light, exposed to anyone who drives by on the country road. But who would be looking for me now? Buck and Mia have handled everything, they think. Meanwhile, Buck is watering the backyard with blood, and Mia is cowering with a knife. The authorities either know I've left Lakeside, or they think I've checked into the inn. Or they think I'm lurking somewhere in the darkness, ready to strike again. No matter what, they are wrong. All of that extra police security is totally unnecessary. I'm here, pumping gas at a desolate country gas station. I'm a tired man, just hoping to make it home to his boys soon. Sunrise isn't until about 6:45 a.m. I have plenty of time. My boys, the joys of my life. Mikey and Sam will be so happy to see me. I might even sneak into their bedrooms, give them each a fatherly hug. They loved having me take them to school this morning, begged me to take them to the lake, too. Their disappointed little faces haunt me a bit right now. I'll make it up to them. Maybe a trip to Disneyland. Gretchen would like that, too. Maybe I'll bundle them up and put them in the car and take them to her apartment tonight. It would be such an adventure, way better than Lakeside. We could get on the road before sunrise. I smile at the thought. The four of us, Gretchen, the boys, and I, headed to the happiest place on earth. The boys would be thrilled. The pump stops. I pull out the nozzle, screw the gas cap on, and hurry into the car. As I pull out of the bright white light of the gas station and back onto the country road, I wonder if it's too late to call Gretchen. She has called me four times since I left on my trip with Mia. That's not like her. For my part, I've been declining her calls. She knows better than to leave me a voicemail. It's against our rules. As I pull onto the interstate, I feel a flood of relief wash over me. I've escaped the country bumpkins. No one has followed me. I sigh, relaxing. I know it's late, but I call Gretchen. The phone rings loudly over my car's Bluetooth system. One ring, two rings.
Paul?
Gretchen says. She sounds sleepy. I wish I were in bed next to her. Hi, my love, I say. It's important to have different terms of endearment, I've learned. Mia is honey. Gretchen is my love. Caroline? Well, she is now the bitch. Before, she was babe. Lois was sweetie, until she wasn't. Buck talked to Lois, my busy mind recalls. I need to deal with Buck. I should have killed him in the backyard of my cottage earlier. Soon I'll finish him off. He thinks he's so cool, so tough. He's not. Did you notice how fast I took him down? He dropped like a rock. All talk, no substance.
Why didn't you take any of my calls today? Gretchen asks.
You know why, love. I had to be with Mia, I say. But I've got some good news. I've left her. Everything you've dreamed of for the two of us can come true now.
Paul, some man came to see me early this morning. He said his name was Buck, said it was urgent that we talk, so I let him in, she says.
Her voice is sounding awake now. Urgent. I should have taken her calls.
He wanted to talk about you. Paul, he said such ugly things. And he had photos of a woman's face all beaten up. Said you did it?
Fine. The bastard tried to convince her I'm evil. I will convince her otherwise. Oh, love, I'm so sorry. Buck is crazy. The guy is totally jealous of me. He's our neighbor up at the lake, and he is not right in the head. It seems he's developed a fixation with me. He actually wants to ruin my life with lies and innuendos. Please don't think twice about it. You know I would never hurt a woman. No one loves women more than I do. No one loves you better, right? I say. My hands grip the steering wheel once more. I want to turn around, drive back to the lake, and kill Buck, even though I'm not that kind of guy. It takes everything inside of me to keep heading home to my boys and Gretchen. This is just some cruel game Buck is playing. He's twisted. You don't actually believe him, do you, love?
I don't want to, Paul, she says.
Now her voice is shaky. I imagine her sitting in bed, knees pulled up under chin. She's naked. Maybe I'll drive there first, pick her up, and bring her to my house.
I just don't know what to believe.
What I cannot believe is how Buck and Mia have messed with my life. They will not get away with this. As much as I want to go comfort Gretchen, and I may still, I realize the true power play is back at home, asleep in their beds, waiting for their beloved dad to come home. I know you're frightened, my love, I say in a soothing voice while checking my rearview mirror. I pass a semi-truck, but no one else is on the road. No one is following me, I'm certain. It was reprehensible of Buck to involve you in his ridiculous vendetta. He's a sick man. He needs help. How about this, love? I'll bring over breakfast in the morning. We'll talk all of this through. You've been dreaming about going to the beach together, and now we can. Sound good?
I need to think, she says quietly. I need some space. I'll call you in a few days. Don't call me, Paul, okay?
She is crying. I hear a big sob as she hangs up on me. My mistress just hung up on me. How is this happening? Somehow, in the space of one day, my wife leaves me for another man, and my mistress tells me not to call her. This is all Buck's fault. I should have shoved the pen in his neck or stomped on his trachea in the garden. I want to scream or throw something at someone, but I'm driving and that would be ridiculous. I need to calm down and focus. I'm sweating and I crank up the air conditioning. I tip my neck from side to side until it cracks satisfyingly. I'm still in charge of the situation, or I will be as soon as I am home with the boys. Maybe we'll leave for Disneyland tomorrow. If Gretchen changes her mind, she can join us. I've got to tell her about Disneyland, I realize. I push the button for Gretchen's number. Her contact information is disguised as a restaurant named Savory. Clever, I know. The Bluetooth kicks in and the phone rings. 1, 2, 3, 4.
This is Gretchen, her voicemail announces. Leave a message.
I cannot believe she is ignoring me, ignoring my call. How dare she? This is not acceptable. Rage overtakes me as I hurl my phone at the passenger window and hear the thud as it falls into the crevice between the door and the seat. The only sound in the car now is my ragged breath. I squeeze the steering wheel as my jaw clenches and I stomp on the gas pedal. I'll listen to my playlist. I push the button in my favorite song. Bobby Darin's rendition of Mac the Knife blasts through my sound system as I sing along. I glance in the rearview mirror and see the flashing lights of a police car. I'm out of control. I will make a mistake. My heart is thudding as I slow down to 65 miles per hour. This is not the time to be pulled over. The lights are behind me now and I can hear the sirens. The cop car speeds past me. It's a sign. My shoulders relax. I loosen my hold on the steering wheel, and I turn up my song. Smooth jazz, calm and structured and in control. Just like me.